Welcome to the On Script podcast, your home for world-class conversations on scripture and theology, where you get to meet some of the best in the field. Visit us at onscript.study. Say hello on Twitter at onscriptpodcast and stop by our Facebook page at facebook.com/onscript.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. This is Matt Lynch coming to you from Regent College in Vancouver. Thanks so much for tuning in and listening. We really appreciate all of you who give regularly, who share the word, who give us ratings or reviews on iTunes or an Apple podcast, whatever it's called. But most of all, we appreciate you just engaging and paying attention and wanting to stay up in the field of biblical studies and theology and for your interest over the years. So we've been going since 2016, and so been at it for 8 years now and aren't looking back. We're still planning things. We've got ideas. We have events coming up. So, but all that's possible because of those of you who listen and who give. So thanks so much. Thanks to Jason Stark for producing this episode and to all the many people who make this possible. So enjoy this episode.
Welcome back to On Script. This is Matthew Bates, your co-host today. Well, and would you look what the cat drug in? Chris Tilling is here too. How are you, Chris?
I am all the better for seeing your two lovely faces. No one's going to see your faces. They're only going to hear your voices, of course, which is actually probably a good thing. But for me, it's terrific to see you.
Well, thanks, Chris. Gosh, and you're so nice to me, and I've been rude to you. What's the cat drug in and all of that? And funny story, you were nice to me even last week, as I was looking for a new e-reader, and I put out this, you know, request on Facebook looking for help, and lo and behold, people are mentioning all these different devices to try. I start searching around on Google looking for advice, and discover that I start watching a video, and lo and behold, the video is produced by Chris. Of all people, I just randomly find it as Chris has got this video comparing, you know, Remarkable versus the Supernote. And then Chris answered all my questions on Facebook about what kind of device to get. So, Chris, you're the man.
Thank you very much. I'm just storing up for myself riches in heaven. You know how it is. They've got to outweigh my manifest wickednesses and sins. That's the hope.
Well, you know, you certainly are building up some credit with me, at least. I don't know about with the Lord. So our guest today is Michael Barber. We're discussing his new book, The Historical Jesus and the Temple, Memory, Methodology, and the Gospel of Matthew, published by Cambridge University Press in 2024. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm a big fan of On Script, so this is a privilege. Thanks.
Well, you've been with us before, as we had you with Brant on and with John Kincaid, I believe, Brant Petrie and John Kincaid. So welcome back for round two. And this is a pretty exciting book. You're working on historical Jesus stuff, but you start the study after this. We do have a wonderful foreword by Dale Allison, which it's pretty great to get him on your front cover. But Dale says some nice things about your book, but whenever you actually start into the book proper, you begin in a surprising place. You begin with Thomas Jefferson. Why did you begin there?
Yeah, because I wanted to use the book to not just talk about Jesus and the temple. So the title of the book is The Historical Jesus and the Temple, Memory, Methodology, and the Gospel of Matthew. And I wanted to look specifically at the issue of Jesus's relationship to the temple, but I want to do something broader than that. I wanted to look at methodological concerns that I have with the field and others have had with the field. And basically, what Thomas Jefferson does is he thinks that you can excavate the Gospels like you can excavate an archaeological tell, right? That you can identify all of these layers of accretions and get to the diamonds. As he would say, the Gospels have diamonds in dunghills, and he's going to extract the diamonds from the dunghills. And the way he does that is he wants to look at the Gospels and remove anything that would be offensive to modern sensibilities. And that includes, for him, Jesus's Jewishness. He actually thinks that if there's something in the Gospels that highlights a Jewish idea or a Jewish way of thinking, that is perhaps an obstacle to getting at the real Jesus, as he might want to put it. And I think this entire project is flawed. And so with Chris Keith and Anthony LaDon, Rafael Rodriguez, and Dale Allison, many others, what I want to argue is that this whole approach of trying to divide the Gospels into the material of the Gospels into two different categories of authentic and inauthentic, this whole approach is wrongheaded. And what we really ought to be asking is, why do the Gospels remember Jesus in this particular way? And does that presentation we have in the Gospels have any value to us as historians? So I want to get away from this idea that we can sort of get behind the text and figure out these different layers of development. And I want to just look at the Gospel of Matthew, for example, as a Jewish source, a first century Jewish source. And I want to look at, well, what does Matthew's interest in Jesus have to say about the kind of Jesus that would produce the material that Matthew would be interested in? In other words, what are the kind of concerns that Matthew has as a Jewish writer? Okay, well, if Jesus is a first century Jewish figure, is that relevant? I think it is. I think it's relevant that Matthew has specific Jewish concerns, and I think they can be seen to reflect the kinds of concerns and priorities Jesus himself would have. So that's why I wanted to get into it. And by starting with Jefferson, I wanted to kind of shine a light on the fact that, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I don't know that much historical Jesus research, I'm thinking in particular of those who use the so-called criteria approach, I don't know that it's all that different than what Thomas Jefferson was doing way back in his day. So I think it's time for a rethink. I believe it's time to reevaluate the way we've approached historical Jesus overall. So that's what I'm trying to do in the book.
Yeah, I think it shines. I think your book shines a bright light on methodological concerns,
yeah,
and also on the Jewish question. I think that's actually been kind of a sore point. Chris, did you have a question that you wanted to ask in that direction?
Well, I think we were going to get to method. I mean, Michael, we've had lots of chats in the past and mm-hmm. about the development of your work. And it's something that's been in the process, well, for years you've been working on this. And as far as I understood you, a lot of the reasons for the delay between doctoral work to publication was all about the methodology that you were going to employ, because you were so challenged by the memory studies, Chris Keith and all of these guys. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about this.
Okay, well, let me tell you a little story. So I'm doing a doctoral dissertation on the historical Jesus, and I'm just about wrapping it up. I'm approaching the point where I need to turn it in, and I get on an airplane and I read a book by Anthony LaDon called The Historiographical Jesus. And I was engrossed by the argument. I was incredibly stimulated by what he was saying. And I remember vividly looking out the window of the airplane and thinking to myself, my whole dissertation is wrong. I can't stand by this. Now, of course, I had to defend it and I had to, you know, move on. But when it came time to publish it, I realized that what LaDon was doing was going to radically undermine the confidence that we can have in this approach that has been around for so long, where we think that we can authenticate certain, you know, traditions, say this is the later development, this is the original kernel, because what LaDon is showing is that memory itself is constructive. And so there isn't like a pure memory, an uninterpreted memory of Jesus. Everything that we have, every memory we have is interpretive and is constructed in certain ways. So it's not like we can just go back and have a video recording of what Jesus said and did. And this really threw me for a loop. And I realized after I read that book, I have to learn a whole lot more about memory research. And in particular, I'm going to need to understand how Paul and how the other New Testament writers factor in to Jesus research now, because I need to think a lot more deeply about the way the Jesus tradition is passed on and the way it develops. And so at that point, I was so frustrated. I didn't know what to do next. And I said, you know, what I really need to do is throw myself into Paul. So I got talking to my dear friends, Brad Petrie and John Kincaid. I said, why don't we work on a book on Paul together? So that produced Paul, a New Covenant Jew. And all the while I'm thinking through memory, I'm reading as much as I can, reading every source that I can. Chris Keith was next. I read him next. And then many others to follow. Dale Allison's book was a bombshell for me, Constructing Jesus.
Constructing Jesus.
Yep. And I thought that what he was arguing was essentially right, that we really need to first, as historians, we need to pay attention to the broad contours of the tradition and not build our reconstructions of Jesus on particular sayings and particular passages. And so that got me thinking a lot about, okay, how can I revise a methodology? How can I present a methodology? And then the more I got into it, the more I started to think about the way Matthew has been used. And the way Matthew has been used is as sort of like a source to get to Q. And so we're not actually looking at Matthew's narrative. We're not actually looking at Matthew's overall presentation of Jesus. We're just trying to read through Matthew to get to Q. And Goodacre's work convinced me a while ago that this whole project of Q is suspect. The confidence we have in Q is suspect. And so I don't know if that's a really solid basis for historical Jesus research. But I also wanted to think a lot more about Matthew within Judaism. And so the more I started thinking about Matthew, the more I got drawn into Matthean scholarship. And one of the things that was emerging is this recognition that Matthew isn't a former Jew, just like Paul. He doesn't see himself as post-Jewish. Matthew still thinks he's Jewish. Okay, so what does that tell us about the kinds of things that Matthew is concerned about in writing his gospel? And then working backwards, then how does this help us think about the historical Jesus? So, you know, for example, to just kind of get to a concrete point, one of the criteria that has been used in historical Jesus research is the criteria of dissimilarity for Christianity. So what are we going to do? We're going to find the things in the Gospels that are dissimilar to what the early Christians believed, and that gives us greater confidence in these things' reliability. Now, that seems problematic to me on lots of levels, but the more I'm learning about Matthean scholarship, the more I'm immersing myself in it and participating in the Matthew group and SBL, the more I'm learning from Anders Runesen and Daniel Gertner that Matthew should be read within Judaism. So if we're going to look at Matthew and we're going to look at, you know, the concerns of early Christians, well, actually, they wouldn't see themselves as Christians and not Jews. So now, all of a sudden, dissimilarity to Christianity actually becomes a form of dissimilarity to Judaism, because they don't see themselves as a non-Jewish community. So the more I start thinking through these issues, the more I realize that I think I might have a new approach to the historical Jesus that builds on Dale's method, but then maybe offers Matthew as a kind of interesting way into the historical Jesus question. And so that's what produced the book.
Well, I'd like to ask some more questions about method, as that's important to your project, but also we want to get to your results about Temple. But before we do that, let me introduce you a little bit more fully to our listeners, Michael. So Michael Patrick Barber has his PhD from Fuller Theological Seminary, and he's professor of sacred scripture and theology at the Augustine Institute. He's the author of numerous scholarly articles and publications, including the book we've already mentioned that he co-authored with Brandt and with John, which is Paul, A New Covenant Jew, Rethinking Pauline Theology, published by Erdmans. And Dr. Barber has also written a number of other books, including The True Meaning of Christmas, which is a more public-facing work. He writes for the website thesacredpage.com and can be found on Twitter at Michael P. Barber. Now, I wanted to follow up with your remarks about methodology, as you were mentioning how important memory studies have become in historical Jesus. The Quest for the Historical Jesus. And I wonder how many of our listeners are going to be familiar with the work of LaDon, the work of Alan Kirk, mm-hmm. and others. And I myself need a refresher, as this isn't in my wheelhouse. I've read stuff in this area, but it's been a while. So could you lead us through some dimensions of a memory study that show that memories are constructed and why that might be important? I think in your book, I'm on page, maybe it looks like 27, where you deal with some of this, where you talk about distantiation, narrativization, conventionalization, those kinds of things. How are these important for historical Jesus?
Right. Great question. So the first thing that we want to do is maybe think about what we're not doing. All right. So this might be clarifying. So the standard approach to historical Jesus imagines that we can read the Gospels in such a way that we can identify developments and we can say, okay, this was added by Matthew. This is added by Luke. And so what we want to do is strip back those redactional layers and get to Jesus himself. And so we take a sort of biased stance against anything that looks distinctive, Matthew, Luke, or even, you know, going back to Mark, if you believe in Q, that kind of thing. And what the goal seems to be is to recover the uninterpreted Jesus. Here is what Jesus just said. Here are the facts, right? Just the facts, ma'am. That's all I want, just the facts. And the problem with that is, of course, we recognize that when we are reading the Gospels, we're never going to be able to just simply peel back the layers like we're looking at an onion. And part of the reason for that is, as LaDon and Kirk and others show, is that there's no such thing as an uninterpreted memory, right? So if I think about like Thanksgiving that I celebrated in, you know, 1989, the years of my childhood, right? I don't have like a video recording of that memory from 1989. And as I remember that event, lots of things go into that recollection. And in fact, there might be details from the memory of Thanksgiving of 1987 or 1990 or something like that, because all those Thanksgivings were very similar. They were all at my grandparents' house. We celebrated it in the same way. So memory doesn't involve just recall. Memory involves a constructive dimension. And part of that constructive dimension, as you mentioned, is emplotment, right? The idea that we're going to create a narrative so that we can recall the things that happened. And that narrative has a beginning and has an end. And so the very fact that I'm imposing a narrative structure on the memory itself or on the past, right, is going to be influenced by all sorts of conventions about the way I think stories should look, the way stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so at the end, when I come up with my memory of what happened, it's influenced by all kinds of things, the way I think things should have been in the 1980s or 90s at that time in my life. I have to construct these things to have a beginning, middle, and end, have to have some kind of narrative flow to this. So all of these things are factors in memory. And so when we read the Gospels, if you're trying to get to just like the uninterpreted Jesus, you don't understand how memory works. It doesn't work that way. So the question isn't, can we get to the uninterpreted Jesus? The real question is, why did they interpret Jesus the way that he did, right? And what can we learn from it? And are these interpretations plausible in a first century Jewish context? Which ones are more plausible than not? And so that's maybe in broad strokes what I've learned from these guys. And so in thinking about historical Jesus research, it's not really helpful to try to come up in my mind with the authentic thing that Jesus said. Here is the, you know, the uninterpreted fact of Jesus's ministry. It doesn't work that way. But what I do want to ask is, all right, what can the gospel writers tell us about Jesus vis-a-vis, you know, their memory of him? Why did they remember him in this way? And is it possible that Jesus himself did things that caused him to be remembered in such and such a way? And so that's the kind of backward way that I'm coming into this, right? Starting with the interpretations in the Gospels and then asking, all right, well, what kind of impressions must have Jesus made to give rise to the interpretations that we find in the Gospels.
Yeah, thank you. Chris, did you have a follow-up there?
No, we've had Chris Keith is perhaps a mutual friend. Mm-hmm. So we've had a few chats about all of this. But one of the things that's always struck me is that it's quite theoretical. It's a little bit like theological exegesis can be, you know, there's a lot of theory involved, but not enough practice. And it seems to me you're really starting to put that into practice now. You're mobilizing these discoveries in order to say something concrete, which is one of the reasons I enjoyed it so much.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I didn't want to just write a book on methodology, right? I really wanted to write a book that made a contribution, hopefully, to our understanding of the historical Jesus in a particular aspect of his ministry, his relationship to the temple. But I don't think you can do that responsibly without entering into these broader methodological questions. And honestly, I've learned so much from Ladon and Keith. If you read my dissertation, which I hope you don't, and then you read this book, you'll see, you know, I've changed my mind about lots of things. Frankly, that's one of the things I admire most about Dale Allison is his ability to rethink things. Very few scholars, as you both know, are willing to say in print, I think that was wrong, what I used to think, and now I've changed my mind. And I just admire that humility so much. I've always been a fan of Dale's work. I've always learned from him. And one thing I hope I've learned from him is the ability to retract positions, to be open to new ideas. And so I was willing to really rethink everything from the ground up. And that's what this book was trying to do, but not in just a methodological mode, but apply it, like you said, Chris, to a particular aspect then of Jesus' ministry. I hope people enjoy it. We did get some exciting blurbs. I was thrilled to get blurbs, not just from Dale, but in Amy Jill Levine, Rafael Rodriguez, Chris Keith, and the late Donald Sr., Catholic biblical scholar. So it was good to get different scholars to read it from different perspectives. You know, Amy Jill Levine is very different than, say, Donald Sr., but it was helpful to me to put it in front of them and get their feedback. And it seemed like this was an approach that found agreement among different scholars of different stripes.
I have one more question on method. And then yeah. I know Chris stayed up all night last night thinking of devious questions for your speed round.
Oh my.
So, I mean, we want to turn that over to him as quickly as possible, but last method question. You settle on the triple context method that was articulated by E.P. Sanders. Mm-hmm. And that just might be helpful for folks to know, well, what is that and why did you settle on that method?
Yeah, so the triple context method was first articulated by Sanders and then revised by Brant Petrie. And what I'm doing is I'm giving a slightly different spin on this than others have used. The first thing I want to consider, as I pointed out before, was what are the broad strokes of the tradition? So let's get specific. Jesus's relationship to the temple. What do we learn about Jesus's relationship from the temple, not just from the temple, so-called temple cleansing episode, right? But what do we learn when we step back and we look at all the traditions as a whole about Jesus, all the different material in the gospel? So I want to do something broad first. And then the second thing I want to do is I want to consider the broad outlines, the broad impressions in light of Jesus's Jewish context. So do these broad impressions make sense and how do they make sense? How do they relate to Second Temple Judaism? And then the third thing that I want to do is I want to think about the way these aspects of the Jesus tradition, the broad contours, can be explained in light of the effects of Jesus. So, for example, one thing that I'm going to highlight over and over again is that Jesus doesn't reject the holiness of the temple per se. Jesus does not come to expose the temple as a corrupt domination institution. Jesus thinks this whole idea of a temple needs to be done away with. It's opposed to the egalitarian vision that I have for the world or whatever. You know, the liberal Protestants in the 19th century would have trouble with the ritual aspect of Judaism and would want to move beyond that. But I don't think there's evidence in the tradition for that. So I want to look at those that broad aspect. But then, okay, how does this make sense of what we know about the early community? And in the book of Acts, we have memories of the early community going to the temple and worshiping. Well, isn't that interesting that the early community seems to have continued to worship in the temple? In Acts 21, Paul goes to the temple and apparently pays for sacrifices to be offered there. So what does that tell us about Jesus? Well, if Jesus was going around giving everyone the impression that the temple itself was backward thinking, that it was problematic, that the temple itself needs to be rejected, then why were all the disciples going back to the temple to worship? This doesn't make any sense. So I want to look at these three things: the broad concept, the broad outline of the tradition, the context of the Second Temple period, and the effects of Jesus, to make a then argument, what can we say is plausible about Jesus? And then the next step I take in the book is, and what does Matthew in particular add? What does Matthew's Jewish perspective then add to that consideration?
Well, can I just follow up with just one more method question, but just a quick
Please.
Answer
yes.
to this one,
yeah.
if you can, because yeah. it seems to me that this was hugely important for how you structured your chapters as well, mm-hmm. namely recurrent attestation.
Yes.
How, just in a nutshell, A, what is it? And B, how is that different from multiple attestation as a criterion?
Right. So multiple attestation is going to look at things that appear in different sources and in different forms, right? In different types of Jesus teaching. So parables or a controversy story or something like that. So again, you can just see that the criteria approach, so the criterion of multiple attestation, is deeply rooted in a form critical approach, right? You can hear the language of form and redaction criticism there just in describing it. Recurrent attestation isn't that. So recurrent attestation is looking at just, is there an abundance of material that point us in a particular way? So Dale, in his book, Constructing Jesus, will look, for example, at Jesus's identity as an eschatological prophet, right? So is there evidence that Jesus is an eschatological prophet? Now, multiple attestation is dealing with the question of, is this in Q? Is this in Matthew? What are the different sources? Recurrent attestation is just asking an even broader question. Is this something that is that appears not just in different forms and in different sources, but does it appear frequently, broadly? So Jesus as an eschatological prophet appears in lots of different places, many, many different places. And what Dale says is, if the Gospels are wrong, if Jesus did not in any way give the impression that he was an that he was teaching in a way that drew from Jewish eschatological hopes, then the Gospels can't be trusted on anything, because this is so deeply embedded in the Gospels that if it's wrong, they're wrong about this, then there was really no telling they're right about anything else. So I want to do that in this book. I want to look at the broad strokes of the tradition. So in this particular book, I'm looking at Jesus' relation to temple and cult. And one of the fun parts of the book is realizing how much that cultic language and that cultic imagery can be found strewn throughout our sources. And it often has just been unidentified by scholars, because so much contemporary biblical scholarship has been done by people who are nervous about the ritual dimension of Judaism. And so there are lots of things in our sources that use cultic language that we just miss. I'll just give you a for instance. In the beginning of the book of Acts, the apostles are figuring out who should take Judas's place. And what do they do in order to determine that? They cast lots. Now, what's going on here? They're just gambling to figure out who gets Judas's job? Holy craps. I mean, what's going on here? Is this just a game, you know? Well, not when you read Acts carefully. So in our mindset, of course, casting lots can be understood as gambling. And indeed, the soldiers, the Roman soldiers, cast lots for Jesus's garments at the foot of the cross. But if we're going to take a textually sensitive approach to Acts, we need to recognize that, of course, Acts is presented as a sequel of the Gospel of Luke. And in the Gospel of Luke, the very first scene is Zechariah going into the temple. And why is he going into the temple? Because it fell to him by lot. And then Luke adds, as was the custom of the priesthood. So the priestly duties were assigned by lot. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Luke begins that way. We see this throughout Jewish sources, that lot casting is associated with priestly responsibilities. I point that out. And so the apostles in Acts 1, when they're casting lots, they're not gambling. They're not taking the role of the apostleship as some trivial thing. No, they're actually doing the same thing Zechariah did at the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. They're recognizing this role has a kind of priestly association. And so it's not a coincidence. Luke begins, you know, his way. And there are lots of parallels, as you all know, between Luke and Acts. We don't have time to go through them all. But for example, the Holy Spirit comes upon Jesus at the beginning of his ministry in a visible form. And that's how Jesus' ministry commences. Likewise, in the book of Acts, the Holy Spirit comes on the apostles in a visible form, and their ministry commences. Jesus' ministry then begins in the Gospel of Luke, when he gives a speech in the synagogue. Peter then commences the ministry of the church with a speech in the temple area. And you can just go right down the list. Jesus heals a lame man. Peter heals a lame man. You just go right down the list, all the parallels. Many people have shown this. But I don't think it's a coincidence that Luke begins with lot casting and Acts begins with lot casting. And the reason that apostles are casting lots is because they still think the priesthood, they still think ritual, they still think liturgy is important. And where did they get that idea? Well, I'm going to argue Jesus himself had a very high view of the temple and didn't reject the idea of temple priesthood and cult. So that's basically it in broad strokes.
Yeah, that's a helpful illustration of the method, I think. And also it gives us a little of the fruit of your work. Chris wants to hit you with the speed round questions right now. Are you ready with those, boy. Chris?
And remember, yeah, I've been dreaming these up for a while.
Oh, boy. Michael. He's rolling up his sleeves. Yeah. I can see this on
the screen. I'm actually doing this. And so, yeah, the you know how it is. You've just got to give your knee-jerk response here. And at least one of my questions has a little bit of unusual preamble.
Okay.
But here we go. Okay, so the first question. Your favorite burger restaurant, and I'm using the word restaurant loosely, of course.
My favorite restaurant is In-N-Out.
Burger restaurant.
No.
In-N-Out.
My favorite of all. I have the palate of a 9-year-old boy. Okay?
Okay.
In-N-Out. I love so, In-N-Out.
In-N-Out. So if In-N-Out burger is so great, why haven't any been opened in the UK or actually in the whole of Europe? I mean, doesn't this imply that their burgers are worse than, say, McDonald's or Five Guys, especially given the importance of recurrent attestation?
I do see the challenge there. Yeah. Unfortunately, as much as I love In-N-Out, I'm not going to put In-N-Out on the same level of Jesus. And so at the same level as Jesus himself. So I'm going to have to just say that the criteria of recurrent attestation needs to be understood in a particular way here. And so it's not geography, but I would say it is the fact that when they opened In-N-Out in Denver, which is where I live, thanks be to God, we have a In-N-Out in Denver now, very grateful. The line for In-N-Out was 18 hours long. So I would just go through that line and poll all of those people who are waiting for 18 hours and ask them, is it worth waiting in line for 18 hours for In-N-Out Burger? Now, I wouldn't have been interviewed because I didn't want to wait in that line. But when they did open other new burger chains here, they did not have 18-hour lines. So,
wow.
Yeah. What's going on with that place?
The cutting edge of New Testament scholarly debate here. But, okay, as you know in your book, Mark's Gospel has annotated an episode to state that thus Jesus declared all foods clean, right? Mark 7.
That's right.
Matthew, however, leaves this sentence out in a way clears up some misunderstanding, representing perhaps a more carefully kosher, Jewish,
sensibility. I noticed that In-N-Out Burger runs hamburgers. So my question, my final question in your speed round is, what kind of eschatological judgments will kosher Jesus visit on In-N-Out Burgers, you think?
Ah, boy. I suspect the judgment that Jesus would rain down would be very gentle, because he would look at In-N-Out Burger and recognize that this is what he was talking about when people would come from east to west and sit at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They'd sit down for a double-double in an animal-style order of French fries. So
you heard it here, folks.
Well, I have an appendix I need to add to this speed round. Now,
yes.
Now, Michael, I know you're a Dodgers fan, which disturbs me. Have you eaten a Dodger dog at Dodger Stadium?
Many times. Yes.
And so how does the Dodger dog, which I'm pretty certain is made from crushed up cigarette butts and the blood of Giants fans, clearly not kosher. How does it compare to an In-N-Out Burger?
Well, I do like Dodger dogs. They have changed the Dodger dog about 2 years ago. They used to use Farmer John. I know way too much about this stuff. They use a different hot dog now. I think it tastes different, but I still like it. But I will say, if you ask me what I would prefer, I will always choose an In-N-Out hamburger over any other. This is not great for a marriage. You know, my wife likes very nice food, and she would like to go to a nice steakhouse or something like that for an anniversary or some special occasion. And I'm perfectly content to have In-N-Out. That would be perfectly fine by me. But again, I have the palate of a 9-year-old boy. So, I'm pretty frustrating.
Well, let's jump back into the historical Jesus in the temple. Let's cut right to the heart of the chase here, as Jesus does a number of things in the temple that scholars have wanted to analyze. Mm-hmm. He throws over tables. He drives out animals. He prevents people from carrying vessels through the temple. He says, you know, my house should be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you've made it a den of laestes, whatever laestes might mean, of thieves or robbers or bandits, variously translated. What is Jesus doing in the temple? He's probably doing more than one thing, but especially in terms of your reconstruction of the historical Jesus, as you're trying to touch on the various threads of his aims, what do you think he's up to?
I'm not, again, trying to get behind the texts. So in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus cites two prophetic passages. He quotes from Isaiah 56, and he quotes from Jeremiah 7. And so in the Matthean, Markan, and Lucan presentations, you have this idea that Jesus's act is linked in one way, in one sense, to Jewish hopes for an eschatological temple. My house shall be called a house of prayer. And in Isaiah 56, we have this vision of, in the future day of Israel's restoration, there is going to be a temple. So the idea that there won't be a cult, the idea that there won't be priests, that the idea that there won't be any kind of sacrificial offering, the idea that that would be the new covenant age or the eschatological age, the age to come, whatever you want to call it, that's very foreign to a Jewish mindset. There is going to be an eschatological temple for Isaiah, and the Synoptic Gospels present Jesus as affirming that. But then Jesus also quotes from Jeremiah 7, which is, of course, a judgment oracle against the temple of Jeremiah's day. And so I think what the Synoptic writers are doing is they're presenting the temple act of Jesus as an instance where Jesus is announcing the coming destruction of the temple, right? So there is a prophetic judgment aspect there. But by linking it to Isaiah 56, the gospel writers prevent you from attributing to Jesus an anti-cultic view or an anti-temple view per se. Judgment is coming and the temple is going to be destroyed, but that's not because temple priesthood and sacrificial worship are in and of themselves a problem. Jesus is affirming Isaianic vision. I think what Jesus is saying is there is going to be an eschatological temple, but this isn't going to be it, right? And there's actually a lot of interesting things you can see in Josephus's account of the Herodian temple. Scholars have argued, and I think they're right, that in Josephus, we see evidence that they were trying to, and in the rabbinic literature, they're trying to build the Herodian temple in such a way as to map onto Ezekiel's eschatological temple. So there may have been people who thought, well, this could be it. This could be the eschatological temple. And Jesus is making very clear, this is not the case. Now, in the Gospel of John, we also have a scene of Jesus in the temple. And we don't have the same quotations from Isaiah, but nonetheless, it's again charged with eschatological imagery and judgment imagery. And I think in the background of both passages, you have an allusion to the Zechariah passage that talks about how in the future day, there won't be a traitor in the house of the Lord. And so, again, we have a common understanding here among all the sources that Jesus is an eschatological figure, that he's evoking hopes for an eschatological temple, but he's indicating that this present temple is not going to be the eschatological temple. And of course, in John, his body is the temple, right? And so that's the way it's understood. So again, I'm taking this recurrent attestation account, looking at the broad strokes of the tradition. My view of Jesus's relationship to the temple isn't solely based on that one episode, but broadly, what can we see? Jesus affirms the holiness of the temple. Jesus also affirms the temple is going to be destroyed. These things may sound contradictory, but they weren't for a Jew like Matthew, who could put them side by side. So how could Matthew see these things as side by side? Well, how could Jesus see these things side by side in a Jewish framework? That's what I'm trying to get at in the book.
So a follow-up question there then. Some scholars have argued as part of the imagery there with Jesus as he, like, for example, is releasing animals, that these would have been a way of stopping the sacrificial system per se, or the preventing of carrying vessels. This would have prevented the operation of the cultists from moving forward for that day. That could be construed as a sort of anti-cultic statement by Jesus. Do you want to speak to that issue specifically and how your reading that would differ or interact?
Yeah, so some people want to take this view that Jesus just rejected the holiness of the temple per se and the validity of the temple per se. One of the biggest problems with that view is in all of the Gospels, Jesus celebrates the Passover. Right? And what do you do to celebrate the Passover? You have to offer a sacrifice in the temple, right, as part of that. And we see that explicitly, for example, in the Gospel of Mark, where we have the animals being sacrificed at the time when you would normally offer the sacrifices. Now, it's interesting. I think scholars have misread that. I think some people have misread this passage. It's frequently overlooked, but I just highlight it. It's in Mark chapter 14. I just grabbed my the closest Bible to me, which was the NRSV. And here is what we read in Mark chapter 14. On the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb is sacrificed, the Greek word there is Pascha, we read, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go to make preparations for you to eat the Pascha?" So what is Pascha here a reference to? It's a reference to the lamb. Mark has just made very clear that this is the day that the lamb is sacrificed. Where do you want us to go eat the Pascha? So people hear, where do you want us to eat the Passover? And they imagine that it would be possible to have a lambless Passover. But that's not possible when you read it in context. In Mark, Jesus is telling them to go prepare the Pascha by having the lamb sacrificed in the way that the Passover lamb would normally be offered. So the idea that Jesus then thinks the temple is invalid, that sacrifice is a problem, is problematic because that's clearly not the case there in that passage. So I think you've got to look at the broader narratives of the Gospels. Can you take one passage out of context and make it say, oh yeah, Jesus seems to be anti-cultic here? For example, Jesus halts the activity in the temple. All right, in the so-called temple cleansing act. Oh, so that must be a sign that Jesus rejected the cult per se. That's possible. Okay, let's look at the rest of the gospel. Well, Jesus goes on to announce that one stone will not be left upon another. Jesus goes on to announce that the temple is going to be destroyed. And he quotes from Jeremiah 7 in the temple episode. So what is Jesus actually announcing? He's announcing that the temple is going to be destroyed, but there isn't clear evidence that Jesus is saying, oh, but everybody should abandon the worship of the temple, animal sacrifice, the sacrifices being offered in the temple are inherently evil and we should stop doing that. How do you get to that conclusion if after all that, then Jesus instructs the disciples to go and sacrifice in the temple and prepare the Paschal lamb in the way that the lamb is supposed to be prepared? So that's how I would respond to it. But we'd have to go, you know, verse by verse. So you can take any one out of context. You have to look at it within the larger context of the gospel and figure out, okay, does that make the most sense of the larger context of the gospel you find, whatever particular tradition you find? So in Matthew's gospel, Jesus says, God prefers mercy, not sacrifice. And he's quoting from Hosea. And people go, look here, Jesus rejects sacrifice. No, that's not what he's saying. This is an idiom. What he's saying is God prefers mercy over sacrifice. You can't possibly conclude that Matthew understands that as a repudiation of all temple holiness when in Matthew 23, Jesus makes it very clear that you are not to swear by the altar that makes the gift, the sacrifice, holy. So the altar actually makes sacrifices holy in Matthew 23. So if you want to read that mercy, God desires mercy, not sacrifice, in a hard anti-cultic way, you're not making sense of the way it fits in the rest of the gospel. So that would be my response to that.
Chris, did you want to jump in with, you had some questions about ecclesia. Did you, you want to jump in with those?
Yeah, that might be a good
somewhere else.
Do so. I mean, first, maybe you could just speak to how you weave in the language of ecclesia.
Sure, right.
Into your presentation first,
sure.
And then we can reflect upon it.
So first of all, ecclesia only appears on the lips of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. So I don't want to make that some kind of cornerstone to my argument here. Again, I want to look at the broad strokes of the tradition. One thing that I think is evident is that Jesus speaks of the community in terms of a temple. And you see this in lots of different places. It's not just in one verse. So the classic place to go to show that, B.F. Meyer did extensive job of this in his book, The Aims of Jesus. The classic place to go is Matthew 16, where Jesus explicitly uses the language of ecclesia. And if you look at the context of Matthew 16, as Meyer, as Davies and Allison, many others have shown, the whole scene there of Jesus and Peter and his confession of faith and Jesus' explanation he's going to build the church, it's all anchored in temple traditions, right? So who do you say that I am? Peter ultimately confesses Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And by referring to Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God, he's referring to Jesus as the Davidic Messiah, which makes sense in the broader narrative of Matthew. Jesus is clearly the Messiah ben David. You see that in the very first verse of the gospel. So we shouldn't expect Peter to say anything different in the gospel of Matthew. Really, he identifies Jesus as the Son of God, the Messiah. Well, of course, Solomon in 2 Samuel 7 was identified as the Son of God. We see that. But in 2 Samuel 7, he's not just identified as the Son of God, right? 2 Samuel 7 is where God swears his covenant oath to David, or 1 Chronicles 17. Actually, it's very likely that Matthew is more dependent on the chronicler than 2 Samuel, but that's a conversation for another day. But in 2 Samuel, what happens? David wants to build the Lord a house. God turns around. And God says, no, I'm going to give you a house. God loves puns. You're going to build me a house, a temple? Well, guess what? I'm going to build you a royal house, and I'm going to give you a royal son, a dynastic successor. And that son is going to build me a house, a temple. And so it's very interesting that Solomon's identity as Son of God is typically associated with his role as temple builder. And I give all the texts, not just from the Bible, but also other Second Temple Jewish texts, that links Solomon's identity as Son of God to his identity as temple builder. So Peter says to Jesus, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build. So Jesus is now going to build, because that's what you would expect the Son of David to do. He's going to build something. What is he going to build? Ecclesia. he's going to build the church. And so in Matthew 16, the church is placed in the role you would expect the temple to be. And I could say a lot more about Matthew 16. I've written about this for many years. It's in a JBL article that I did. It's in this book as well. But so in Matthew 16, the ecclesia is identified with temple imagery. But here's the thing. That's not like just Matthew. You see this throughout the synoptic gospels. You see the community being identified in temple terms. One of the clearest examples of this in my mind is the parable of the wicked tenants. Right. So in the story of the parable of the wicked tenants, you have that account of a vineyard, right, that's lent out to tenant farmers. And scholars have long recognized that the story is drawing from the imagery of Isaiah 5. There are incredible parallels between Isaiah 5 and especially the Matthean and Markan version. But, you know, I think you see echoes of it in Luke as well. And at the end of the parable, everybody knows what happens, right? He sends the different servants to come. And then finally, he sends his beloved son, thinking that they will respect him. And they end up killing the beloved son. And then they ask, okay, well, what is the owner going to do? Or it's presented differently in the different gospels. But the idea then is that the owner is going to come and bring judgment on the tenant farmers, right? Now, in the tradition and lots of different people in modern scholarship have identified this as an anti-Israel parable, that God is going to replace Israel with the church. But that's a huge problem because the imagery is not a different vineyard. It's just the different tenant farmers. So the tenant farmers are going to be replaced. Well, who are the tenant farmers in image of? Well, in all three synoptic gospels, the chief priests and the other leaders recognize that Jesus told the parable against them. And so the whole point is that Jesus is going to replace the leadership. He's not going to replace Israel, but he's going to replace especially the priestly leadership. Jesus tells the story within the context of the temple. And then at the end of the parable, he quotes from Psalm 118. It's a weird move if you don't understand the context. But Jesus then goes and he quotes from Psalm 118, the stone that's rejected by the builders has become the head of the corner. And that's a kind of weird thing. You're talking about vineyard, and now all of a sudden you're talking about a temple building exercise. So Psalm 118 is most likely a psalm about temple building. There are lots of reasons to think that, but let's just stipulate that here. And so what's fascinating is Jesus ends that parable with a temple building image, right? But he identifies the stone that the builders rejected as the top stone or the cornerstone, some translations. I think top stone's better. What is that top stone? It's him, right? And the reason it works is there's all kinds of interesting things happening that it suns and stones sound a lot. Ben and Eben sounds a lot similar in Hebrew. It's a common Jewish pun, right? As the high priest have 12 stones on his breastplate to represent the 12 sons of Israel, right? So there's this pun, a traditional pun on sun and stone. And so Jesus is moving from the parable about the beloved son to the image of a rejected stone. And that works really well because Isaiah 5, as many scholars have shown, was connected to the temple in Jesus' day. Jesus tells the parable in the temple. And and then he ends with this temple image of the temple building stone. Now, the question that interpreters have then is, okay, well, if there's a temple building image here, we have the stone, what's the rest of the temple? And virtually unanimously, from Adela Yarbrough Collins to Davies and Allison, people recognize this is an image of the community. That Jesus is not the entirety of this new temple that's being constructed. There is going to be a new temple that's constructed, but it's not just him. He's just the top stone. And in 1 Peter, this logic is drawn out even further of Psalm 118, where we are all living stones. But I think 1 Peter is just making explicit what is implicit in the parable in all these places. So the idea then is Jesus does announce that the temple is going to be destroyed, but he also identifies the community as a temple. And so that's why in Matthew, the ecclesia is a temple. Matthew isn't doing anything in Matthew 16 that you don't find in many other places. And we can talk about all the other traditions. I don't have time to get through them all, but just give you one other one. For example, the Sermon on the Mount, a city on a hill, a light of the world. You're the salt of the earth. What connects all these things? A city on a hill, a light and salt, temple imagery. And other people have highlighted this, right? That Jerusalem is more of a temple with a city than a city with the temple. And the idea of the light on a hill, in many eschatological traditions, this is the idea of the radiance of the glory of God from the temple at Mount Zion. And salt, people often see the salt imagery as, you know, preservative. Well, they didn't have refrigerators. You know, people always get to that. Right? Well, they didn't have refrigerators, so they had to have salt. But people miss the fact that salt is typically used as an ingredient in sacrificial worship. And so the salt imagery also fits really well with that. So what is Jesus saying about the community? It's basically identified with the eschatological Zion, right? And so Zion, temple are interchangeable in various Jewish sources. So there's just another text where I think we've missed temple imagery, cult imagery, like, for example, the casting lots in Acts 1. People miss that as a cultic image. People miss the cultic image there. People broadly, commentators recognize these things, but you've got to really read the scholars who've worked with these texts deeply to, okay, this is a temple image. I didn't realize that, right? So I'm drawing all these things together and making the argument that Jesus does announce that the temple is going to be destroyed. He also envisions the community as a temple, which is similar to what you see in Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls, and arguably the Pharisees. Some people think the Pharisees were about teaching people how to live temple holiness in their own lives, right? So it fits within a Jewish context as well. So it's broadly attested, fits within a Jewish context, makes sense of the effects of Jesus, because, for example, St. Paul will just come out straight and say the church is a temple. Right.
So. Thank you, Michael. We have just a couple minutes left, so I'm going to ask you just a couple more speed round questions for fun, and then I've got a last question that can serve as your sort of final statement, at least for now, on a historical Jesus issue.
I like that, for now. Thank you for saying that.
For now.
I'm Allisonian, yeah. Very Allisonian. I'm
all right.
Ready to revise my opinion maybe later.
So for your speed round, Ferris Bueller's Day Off or The Princess Bride?
Princess Bride.
What do you love most about being a father?
Watching my children grow and learn from their mistakes. I think that's the thing that I love most, is watching my children grow up to be young men and women of integrity. We have 6 children, so from 15 down to 7. And watching them make decisions that define who they are, as opposed to their friends. Can I give an example real quick? And this is a speed round, I know, so maybe I shouldn't say too much, but I'll just give one example. My son is a pitcher, plays youth baseball at a very elite level. And there was a game where a coach was really upset with the other team. And the coach told my son to hit the batter. This is a youth baseball game. They're like 13 years old. And my son refused to do that. And he got taken out of the game because he wouldn't do it. And that's one of my proudest moments as a father, is my son said, "Nope, that's wrong. I could cause someone to get hurt. I'm not going to do something that's wrong because the other team is doing things that are wrong. And I'm willing to sacrifice my opportunity to pitch in this game for that." It gets me a little emotional. So we better move to the next question.
Awesome. What's your least favorite type of exercise that you do regularly?
Walk upstairs.
All right. What's the coolest vehicle you've ever been in?
Let's see. It was a convertible Ford Mustang. About a year after my wife and I were married, we took a little trip, and my wife surprised me by renting this amazing car for a day. And we drove up the coast in California with the top down, 70-degree weather. It was beautiful.
Wow. All right. And so we're done with the speed round. Here's your last, your final statement for now on the historical Jesus. I've got a zinger for you to end it. Did the historical Jesus put himself forward as the true high priest?
Oh, that's interesting. True is an interesting question there. And I like how you put that. Did he put himself forward? Right, because I think a lot of what Jesus is doing is obscure. It's obscure to his followers. It's only after he dies that they start putting together the various things that he said or did. And we see this throughout the Gospels. Then they remembered. Then they recalled. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that Jesus in his, I don't think it would be right to say in his public ministry, Jesus went around saying, "Hi, I'm the real high priest," you know? And I don't think Caiaphas rends his garments at the trial because he thinks Jesus is trying to take his job away from him. I don't think that's what's happening at all. But at the same time, I would say that Jesus does things that are loaded with meaning, that in the aftermath of his death causes disciples to realize that he was acting in priestly ways, ways that evoked priestly traditions, and that he saw his death as the sacrifice that initiated an entire new covenant. And in as much as he did that, he can be understood in priestly terms and I think in high priestly terms because he's offering the sacrifice himself to the Father. But I don't think that if you had walked around with Jesus and the disciples during his public ministry, they would have thought that or they would have understood that yet. That only is made clear after his death and after, I think, from a faith perspective, the Spirit is guiding the church to come to a deeper understanding of this.
Well, I think that's well articulated. And I, one of the strengths, I think I probably speak for Chris too, this was a very well-researched and argued book. One of the strengths and that for me, you gave me a lot to ponder were the Davidic connections specifically to the temple. As I just had not thought so much about that, I think you forced me to think more about the relationship between Davidic Messiah and the temple more than I have before. Anyway, excellent book, and we appreciate it. We appreciate having you on, Michael.
Very much.
You've been listening to On Script, hosted today by Matthew Bates and Chris Tilling. Our guest has been Michael Patrick Barber, the author of The Historical Jesus and the Temple: Memory, Methodology, and the Gospel of Matthew, published by Cambridge University Press in 2024. A link for purchasing is on our webpage, www.onscript.study. Until next time.
You've been listening to OnScript, delectable conversations on scripture and theology. If this episode has brought you inner peace or lit your biblical fire, please consider a small donation of just $2 or $5 per month. Information on how to donate can be found at onscript.study/donate.